Aloha, straight from Hawaii. You guys are about to meet my, one of my heroes. See, a few years ago, I heard that Johnny Depp got drunk at an award show, and I went online to see the video of it. And you know what? He seemed a little off to me for sure, but ultimately I didn't really care about it. What I did care about, though, was as soon as his mic was cut off, and it was cut off, they went off to a trailer for this thing called Supermensch, a documentary about a guy I never heard of before, Shep Gordon. And all these celebrities started talking up about how much he helped them, how he made them famous. People like Chef Emeril Lagasse, the rock star Alice Cooper, the Dalai Lama were all on camera. And so I went out and I got the documentary. And this guy is so freaking creative. I just kept watching it. 30 times I watched his documentary. And I'm not someone who watches things over and over again. But Supermensch was just like this thing that I would always keep on in the background because I loved the creativity. I loved the way it was put together. And I got his book too when he came out with a book. It's called They Call Me Supermensch. I used the audiobook to fire me up, to give me ideas. I did this run, 21 miles. I set out to do 4. I ended up 21 miles because I just kept wanting to listen to the audiobook. And I really recommend it. It's called They Call Me Supermensch, a backstage pass to the amazing worlds of film, food, and rock and roll. And I'm so honored to have him here as my guest, thanks to two sponsors. The first is Top Tal. The second is Acuity Scheduling. I'll tell you more about them later. But first, Shep, the legend, thanks for being here.
Aloha, great to be here, and what a beautiful introduction. Thank you.
Be honest with me. I mean, did you have a hand in getting Johnny Depp drunk or whatever he was at that?
Well, I really don't think he was drunk. Johnny is not a public speaker. He's very, very uncomfortable in public speaking. I'm very uncomfortable. That's why you never see him do it. And when I went up, he was shaking.
Really?
He was literally shaking.
I see. So it was just that he wasn't. I see.
And I don't think he was drunk at all. I mean, I didn't ask him. I couldn't smell it. But I think he was really just nervous.
You did look a little horrified in the audience like you hadn't planned it. But you have to forgive me for thinking that you did because you know what? I saw the documentary. Like I saw things like how you got Alice Cooper naked on stage except for something. And then you call. Can you tell that story? I think it'll give people a sense of the way that you operated back then.
You know, this is 1968 or 69, mm-hmm. and we were young guys with no real boundaries, and we rock and roll was the thing to do. Alice was a band. I was a pharmaceutical salesman looking for a more legitimate path.
And oh, wait, pharmaceutical salesman means?
Selling drugs and not without a license.
I see. Okay. Like Jimi Hendrix was one of your clients of the pharmaceuticals. Okay, yes.
What we talked about, Allison and I, was that maybe a faster path to stardom and money, because that was our goal. Stardom really wasn't important. We wanted to buy lunch. None of us had any money. We saw that this common thread in people like Elvis Presley. As a young child, Alice and I were very affected seeing Elvis Presley on the Ed Sullivan Show, and they wouldn't show his hips. And that's when we all went to him, because our parents said, he's disgusting.
Yeah.
The Beatles, they were disgusting. They had long hair. The Rolling Stones urinated on gas stations. The thing they all had in common was parents heard about him and told their kids not to go see him. So we said, okay, how do we get parents to tell their kids not to go see us? Maybe that's an easier path. And let's get arrested for indecent exposure. Let's play. We'll get the police to arrest us. The parents will read it in the newspaper and go, oh, my God, a guy named Alice Cooper naked on Sunset Strip. This is disgusting. So we spent maybe our last $30 on clear plastic, which we made into suits, a fatal error. And there was a club on Sunset called The Experience. A fellow named Marshall Brevichstone, and he let us get up for 15 minutes before Buddy Miles, who was headlining that night. And in those days, it was phone booths. And usually they were by the bathroom in a restaurant or a club. So I went to the phone booth where I couldn't see the stage, put the band on naked in clear plastic suits, maybe 5 people in the room, and called the police and said, oh, my God, this is the most disgusting thing I've ever seen. This 5 guys with long hair down to their legs. I think they may even be gay. and they're naked, and I have my children here, and you can't do this. Hear the sirens coming about 60 seconds later, because LA was a police state at the time. So there were police everywhere on Sunset Strip. You didn't have to wait for them. But by the time they came, the heat of their bodies had fogged up the plastic. So the police came in, looked around, and left.
And they just saw.
But we had our path. We knew it. That was our journey. And we looked at each other and said, you know, I think it's time to get out of LA. We can't even get arrested.
With all the police everywhere, you still couldn't get arrested. So that didn't do it. Yeah. What did do it for you then?
The thing that really got it was we went on the road. We ended up in Detroit. We got an ovation in Detroit at a festival maybe 3 months later. From my college connections, I ended up being hired because they thought I was now a rock and roll genius because I was managing a band to do a festival that John Lennon was going to be on in Canada. I said I would do it if Alice could go on before John Lennon. He ended up going on Between the Doors and John Lennon. And he threw a chicken off stage that night. And the chicken got ripped apart. And the headline the next day was, Alice Cooper tears the head off a chicken and drinks its blood. And that went viral in a time when you couldn't, there was no viral, but it went viral.
Yeah.
And that's what made him. That's really, that was the defining moment of the career.
You know what, for a long time, Shep, if you wanted to be a musician, it seems like the path was to have everyone's parents hate you. Today, that doesn't seem true anymore. Today, whether it's a musician or an entrepreneur, it's almost like you need to have the parents admire you. Do you agree?
I don't agree at all. I mean, I think grandparents may be different than parents, but I can tell you as a parent, my just a personal story.
Please.
I was walking out of my bedroom 1 o'clock in the morning, 20 years ago, maybe 15 years ago. And I hear coming out of the bedroom, really offensive, loud music.
Okay.
Words that I would never allow in my house for my kids to ever say.
Okay.
And I opened the door and I said, what is this shit you're listening to? And as I said it, I knew that was the next thing. And it was rap. It was, you know, hey, my motherfucker.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I completely agree with you. I think now it's come. Now those people, like my kids, are now parents.
Mm-hmm.
Have kids, and they're playing hip hop, so the kids are going to Adele.
Right.
It's that circle continues.
I see that Adele is kind of too weak for the parents who grew up on hip hop, and that's why the kids are going to them.
To
her.
It's a generation. It just keeps going, and it's that way in every part of culture. It's that way. I'm in the culinary world.
Yeah,
funny. I had a discussion yesterday with someone who was having a birthday, and she said, "Oh, I'm going to the restaurant, but it's so noisy." And we got into this cultural discussion. I said, "I watched this." The same metamorphosis in the culinary arts. When I was a customer, like I was a customer of music, the things that were important to me were that I could get a reservation so I knew I wouldn't have to wait, that I could get a quiet table for my party, that I could hear the other people talking at my table. Those were the things that are important to diners of my age who were foodies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the hot restaurants, you can't get a reservation because they don't take them. There's communal tables. You have to sit with other people, and they're always too noisy.
I see. So you're saying it's always about pissing off the people who came before. If we want to create something new today, we should not ignore that. How do we piss off the people who are there now?
I wouldn't say it's 100%, but I would say that's one cultural revolution.
I see.
That always needs a face.
Okay.
And in terms of being someone who brands things or is looking for creative new ways to touch an audience, those waves are really significant.
You know, you obviously made or you helped make Alice Cooper into a superstar. You said in your book, I wanted to see if my operating principles still worked, if they worked outside of Alice Cooper. And so I went and took on Anne Murray. And that made me think, first of all, I like her music a lot.
Yeah, she's a great artist.
So good. That's the interesting thing about your book. I went and I found some of the music on Spotify to listen to that you referred to. But what I was wondering was, what were your operating principles? What was it that you were looking to test?
And I didn't really know. I think out of the box was a big part of it. I did what I thought of, and that was very unusual. And it worked with Alice because Alice was sort of a freak icon. But did it work in a mainstream way? Could those kind of things really work? And I didn't know, and I didn't want to. My passion is not music, but I felt like I was developing a craft that I was good at. So I wanted to try and see if my principles worked.
Here's one of the principles that you did mention. You said guilt by association is big, right?
Really, and especially in those days, it was very big. It was very different. There were very few media outlets. So if you got a photograph that what I would call went viral, that meant you got Newsweek or Time or Rolling Stone or an AP column that would go,
yes,
you know, it's AP and UPI. If you got an AP photo, you would get to 2,500 newspapers, 3,500 right. newspapers. So if I could message, that was the easiest way for me to get my message across. For Alice, I would do sick things, you know, naked billboards that I could get photos of. Because that for Annie, it was, how do I take someone who is a gifted artist but has no real personality to her audience other than her gifted music. Uh-huh. And my thought was, if I can put the icons of music, the Mount Rushmore, around her, endorsing her, it would give people a look inside and see why these people were doing it. And I felt if they heard her voice, that was my job.
And so one of the people was John Lennon, who hadn't been visible at the time. And you said, look, I went to the Hollywood Vampires, this group that Alice Cooper put together with John Lennon, the lyricist who worked with Elton John and others. And you said, Harry guys, Nielsen, please. Sorry?
That night was Harry Nielsen.
Harry Nielsen.
And Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. And yep. The Monkees were gigantic at that time. Like gigantic.
But here's the thing that I wonder. You said, look, I will do anything for you guys if you let me get a photo taken with you. John Lennon doesn't need anything from you. He's already kind of hanging out with your guy. Leave him alone. I'm wondering, what did you do? What is the magic that you have that gets John Lennon to do this thing that he doesn't want to do for free to help you out, basically to help you build your career and someone else's career? What is that magic that allows you to persuade people? In that case, let's talk about that
specific case. I wouldn't say it's magic. I think it's you know, the way in which you deal with people sometimes comes back to you. And I was very good to all these guys. I was sort of the designated driver.
Okay.
They would get screwed, you know, drunk. They couldn't drive home. I would do anything I could do to facilitate ease in their lives.
And so you had done that for them before?
Oh, yeah.
What's an example of something that you've done for one of them?
I drove all of them, and Harry was a great friend. I spent a lot of time with Harry. Mickey, I'm still close with. Alice, of course. And I was really honest, you know. It was, gas money doesn't come cheap. This okay. could help me get gas money. You want me to keep driving you?
Oh, I see. Okay. You know what? Here's the thing. I never understood how Larry King could have all these celebrity friends. And then I heard him on Howard Stern one time, and he talked about how he is so good at drawing people out. And he told great stories. And I realized, you know what? If he has nothing but that, the ability to express interest in someone in a Dale Carnegie-like way and also a way to tell stories in a fun way, I get why people would keep him around. I'm wondering with you, what is your magic? I still don't know you that well. I only know you through these two products. What is your magic that allows you to have relationships with all these different people who could speak with anyone?
You know, I think maybe I enjoy and have been trained in service. I really enjoy service. And I think people feel it. And that translates into making their lives better. So I think I consciously think about, if I touch someone, I want, it's like Johnny Appleseed.
Yes.
Except I'm planting happiness. And I really think about life like that. What can I do to make this person's life a little better, make this moment a little better? I think if you deal with humans, particularly artists, in a way that they're just humans, you get a lot back. And I'm careful with who I choose to give my service to.
I see. So you weren't just driving any random person who wanted to come home from the whiskey a go-go. You were giving, I see.
People who I knew would give it back and appreciated it and were thankful.
But a lot of times when someone gives...
Or in big need. You know,
or in big need.
Yeah, or in big need.
Like you mentioned Groucho Marx, you went and you helped him get his finances in order in the book. But the thing I'm wondering, though, is there are a lot of people who do that, who are of service to others, and no one takes them seriously because they're like the pets who want to help you out. You're not like that. There's an edge to you, too. I'm wondering why – what do we do if we want to take that lesson from you, of be of service to others, pick the right people? How do we do it in a way that keeps us from looking like we're sycophants or slavishly following them?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question. I think that I think that the body of work you develop in many ways to other people who are professional in what they do sort of defines who you are and the level of respect comes along with it. So it's, I think that then I'm still a groupie. To a big extent. And a part of what makes me a groupie is I understand how difficult it is to get through, to get to that place where someone wants to be your groupie and to keep your smile on your face. So I'm definitely a groupie. I mean, I work really hard to get to the people who I want to meet. And I try and make their lives a little better when I do so they understand that, you know, it's not just give and take.
I see.
But I think it's a body of work. I think, you know, you're for a lot of professionals, especially in the entertainment world, we're all very cautious of the fool's gold aspect of the entertainment business. Mm-hmm. And I guess the tech business today, so strong that it attracts so many people. And it's really the body of work. And I have a reputation in the industry for winning. And, artists love to be next to people who win because every artist thinks that their success is this, their last success was the last one they're ever going to have. It's part of what drives the creativity in an artist. Mm-hmm. Is this constant fear that the well is empty.
I get that. I kind of feel like it's the same for an entrepreneur in the sense that I've been an entrepreneur since I was 20, actually pretty much my whole life. And there's always a fear that I'm going to end up in a box outside, which is why I work hard, you know? Yeah, I pass people here in the Mission in San Francisco who live in tents outside, and I think that could be me next year. I better work harder.
I don't know.
Wow. Yeah.
I probably calculate the interest on my money every day in my jacuzzi.
Literally.
It's so Jewish.
But wow. How much interest have you made last year? Are you liquid? Do you have real cash, or are we going to find out that you worked this hard and there was nothing at the end? Like some of
I don't have what one might think I have, but I have enough to be comfortable. I never was an accumulator. It never was my thing. I mean, when I look back at my career, if there were the only things I would really change was how I dealt with the economics of my career.
Meaning?
I would have. I always felt very independent. I never took any money for anything after I stopped working on it, with one or two exceptions. And the rule in the business was the opposite. So if I managed a Luther Vandross, for example, every other manager in the world would collect on the albums they worked on in perpetuity for as long as Luther did. When I would leave, it was, thank you, give the money to your kids.
I see.
I don't know if it was arrogance, or what I needed for myself, but that's the only thing I probably would have changed. I went backwards, but I don't mean, it's not like I sit and think about it.
Emeril Lagasse Spices, did you own a piece of that?
I still do.
You still do? 50% of the business?
Yeah.
I think I read that there was a book about him and the Food Channel, and I thought, whoa, Shep Gordon, that's what he did. I thought he just helped him get big. So
I did all my business pro bono with all the chefs.
You did?
Yes, with the exception of when I got the Food Network on the air, what I did in lieu of payment for the chefs, I got them one commercial spot in the show. Mm-hmm. So Emeril had one 60-second spot. So I went to Emeril and I said, listen, I'll finance and run some product to put on there. We'll go partners on it. I don't know if it'll work, not work. We'll see what we do. And it was Spices. and I funded it, and we stayed partners. And it was actually a great moment with Emeril when the agency I had put him with got an offer from a very big spice company, B&G Spices, to buy out the company and continue to pay a royalty, but make a huge sum to Emeril overall for all his products. And I only had a handshake with Emeril. You know, I never did contracts with my artist. So he sent me an email from his agent, who I had gotten him, saying, got you this big offer. You know, you don't have anything in writing with Shep, so you really don't have to pay him anything. If you want, I'll take care of it. I'll take the meeting with him. And Emeril sent me the email. And he said, come to next time you're in New York, we're going to meet in the office. I want to read this email in front of him. And he did. And then he said, now we're going to have paper. And we put it into paper 50-50.
Wow. And because you have said, look, I got them all the contracts to lock them and protect them. I never did it for myself.
Right.
All right. There's something that you do that's been sticking in my head ever since I heard you do it. But let me just do a quick sponsorship break and tell people about TopTal. You know, you'd love this thing. TopTal is a company that gets like Google level developers in a network. And when companies need to hire great developers, they go to TopTal and TopTal brings them in part-time, full-time, et cetera. Turns out, Shep, there are a lot of agencies here in San Francisco that will build your iPhone app, your mobile app, your whatever. I said to a friend of mine, how are they doing all this? How do they hire all these developers to do everything? And he said, a lot of them are shadow agencies. What they do is they go to TopTal, like they do maybe iOS, iPhone apps. And then when you say, I need an Android app, they say, oh yeah, we got a developer. What they do is they go to TopTal, they say, I need a developer who will pretend to be on my team, and then I can hire him out to do Android while our guys do iOS. It's a whole big thing, and a lot of companies depend on them because they're that good. If you guys are listening to me and you want a great developer, Google level, Facebook level developer at a great price, and you can actually start off with them tomorrow in some cases, I want you to go check out toptal.com/mixergy. When you do, you're going to discover that not only does this company like – one of the, I think, the unicorns in that they're over $1 billion valuation, investment by Andreessen Horowitz. They're created by a longtime Mixergy fan. So he's giving you 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. Go check him out. Top is in top of the mountain. Tal is in talent. TopTal.com/Mixergy. You know, I didn't have anything in writing with them either. I just kind of knew the guy and...
More better, much more better.
Because frankly, if you do have something in writing, what are you going to do? I'm going to go sue him. He's going to sue me. It's not worth it. We'll lose all our money anyway. Yeah. Here's what you say. In the book, you say that you say thank you every morning, and you actually seem to say it twice in the book.
Yeah.
You never say thank you. So in my head, whenever I'm grateful to someone, like Jason Gaynard introduced me to you, in my head I keep saying, Jason Gaynard, thank you, with your voice in my head. Do you really start out still to this day every morning saying thank you in the mirror?
Yeah, I do.
You do?
Yeah. It's not the first second, and it's not in the mirror. It's usually as I hit the sand on my walk. I live on a beach, and I usually get out there right after sunrise and make a little meditation to say thank you. And thank you, thank you.
Why say that, and what's the benefit of it? Let's talk to the 20-year-old you who would want to understand why he might want to say thank you, thank you. That guy was hustling.
Interesting you would say that, because it's actually a different moment since the election. Mm-hmm. But my thank you is really I am so lucky. You know, I think, first of all, way to drop out of the womb is unbelievable. Like, you know, that I dropped out in America in this time. That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm healthy. I have some love in my life. These days I'm on this most beautiful beach and I have clean air and clean water and all the food I can eat. I'm a very rare, that's rare. I mean, that, you know, for the human species on this planet, that is rare. And I can read through that list every morning and go on for hours.
What list? Oh, the list of things. So here's the thing. If anyone else said this to me, I'd say, woo, guy, I got to just like pay attention for a moment and then move on. Because it's you, Shep, because you've built so much, I feel like there's more than woo-woo to it. I'm feeling like there's something else, and I have to admit, I don't understand what it is, but I feel close to understanding that there's some benefit to it. There's some reason for doing it beyond just showing appreciation. What am I missing here that you're tapping into?
I think, you know, I think in every spiritual journey, repetition, and you know, I went to Bali for the first time, and it's the most amazing. To Thailand for the first time, and it's the most amazing place. It's a Buddhist country. It's a different. The vibe in the air is different, and what they really attribute it to a lot is ritual. They all have little temples in their house or in the yard. They all pick a flower every day and put it in their temple. Mm-hmm. It makes them think about the things that are important and not important. That's what the thank you for me does. It's a ritual that helps me really focus on how lucky I am and makes me happy. And happy is sort of the end goal of my journey. Yeah. I don't know what all the rest of this stuff is. You know, it's stuff I do. But if I can be happy, if I can wake up happy, go to sleep happy, not hurt anybody, that's a nice thing. And having these rituals in my life helped me. You know, there were times when I lived in L.A. when I'd wake up in the morning and say, fuck, fuck, fuck. I don't want to be in that place.
I used to do that, too. And I kind of felt like maybe that anger is what fired me. And now being happy keeps me from having that kind of energy. Mm-hmm. Is there any truth to what I'm saying? Or am I just connecting two things that aren't really related?
I think it's possible. It's possible. I think everything is choices. So it definitely is possible. But I know my choice is happy.
I see.
But these are conscious choices. You can consciously choose to wake up saying, fuck, fuck, fuck. And usually your day will follow that path.
Yeah.
Or you can choose to wake up and say, wow, thank you, thank you, thank you. And
you mentioned Bali. Bali does something similar too. Everyone has their offering in front of their stores. I actually felt so bad. I said, what if I step on it? Because they make these beautiful little square offerings full of flowers and food and money. And sometimes people just step on it accidentally and they're not moved by it. They're not there to be upset that you've just stepped on it, but it does mean something to them. And even the driver who's driving you around will put an offering on his dashboard.
It's their ritual way of remembering to be thankful.
Yeah.
And how lucky they are and that there's something bigger than them.
And, you mentioned visualizing in the book. How do you visualize and how has that helped you?
You know, I can tell you the externals of the process. Okay. I don't really know the internals. For me, when I have so much of my work is what I call non-directional. It's sitting and thinking for hours on something. And then it sort of happens sometimes, most of the time. Sometimes I used to tell all my clients, if you want to know, I can get that for you really fast. If you want a yes, it's a stomach thing. I can't tell you when it's going to happen. And so for me, it's a quiet space. Water works really well for me, jacuzzi. I spend a lot of time in. It's cannabis, marijuana, really.
Smoking.
Yeah, smoking it really gets me to a place where I'm not as grounded. And then I sort of space travel. My focus is on creating history when I do that. It's how do I help my brand create history, do the right thing, send the right message. And I never know, it's just an accumulation of stuff, and somehow I've been very lucky. Something it comes out. I can't give you a clear path to it, but it's definitely by getting away from the realities of the world and getting into a zone where I can time travel.
Mm-hmm. When you say time travel, what do you mean by that? How?
You know, here's an example. My job, I manage an artist named Teddy Pendergrass. There's a lot of great soul singers, R&B soul singers. Mm-hmm. How do I separate his brand in an honest way, make a gigantic statement, and get to masses rather than obscure artists. Mm-hmm. Artists, art appeals to a small audience. Cultural revolutions, cultural waves appeal to gigantic audiences. So, you know, a Jean-Luc Ponty play, maybe the greatest violin player in the world, that's tiny. But you get to, you know, a U2 who play into political rebellion. And it's, so anyway, so how do I define Teddy to his audience without being cheap, with them being able to think they discovered it, all the things you want for your brand? And it took me, that one came really fast. I was, he made me wait outside his dressing room for a couple hours. My first show with him got me really angry. And, I kept thinking about when I got to see him finally, I said, you know, Teddy, this is like crazy what you're doing. I'm really pissed. I said, you sat on a stool tonight. Every lady in that audience wanted to make love to you. And you sat on a stool, man. Just retire. Get out of here. Or give it up. And one thing led to another. I said, you know, we should do a show just for women. Let them all come naked. You be naked. Just do. And as I said it, I said, whoa. And then I went back and I spent maybe 2 or 3 days of joints and thinking and came up with this concept of doing concerts for women only, mm-hmm. which everyone told me I couldn't do. But I saw it. You know, I took that thought and I kept time trying. Okay, which Radio City Music Hall? They dressed to the T's.
Yeah.
What do I want them doing? Oh, let me give them chocolate teddy bear lollipops to lick on.
Yeah.
And I saw that moment. I saw that story. You know, Teddy plays for women only. And I knew that if I could get that story out, that defined exactly who he was. And we get every other woman to want to look in and see why all these women go. So that's one example of what I call time traveling.
Okay, so I'm picking up on a few things here. First of all, guilt by association.
Uh-huh.
Time traveling is this visualization exercise. Weed is part of the process. And the other one was you said a cultural wave. And you and I talked about that before uh-huh. we started. You're looking for a cultural wave. What does it mean? Can you give me an example of a cultural wave that you helped someone ride to?
I would say the culinary movement was a cultural wave. When I was growing up, restaurants were generic,
mm-hmm.
And they weren't in demand. My parents went to a Chinese restaurant on Friday night. Wasn't part of my life. I didn't grow up, get my driver's license and drive to a restaurant. I went to Nathan's or I had a hot dog or maybe we went to a fast food stand, but the concept that an evening of entertainment would be the restaurant didn't exist, wasn't part of the world. As I moved into the early 70s, mid 70s, there started to be this phenomenon of owner restaurants, not with their names normally. But there was a personality, a little touch. So there was like Spago in L.A. And for me as a business guy, if I got really successful, I could maybe get a table at Spago. But I had to maybe win an Academy Award, do something. Mm-hmm. I couldn't just call up and get in. I could do anything. I could buy tickets on the 50-yard line of a football game. I could get to the first row of a Broadway play. But Spago, I couldn't just... Same thing in New York, Le Cirque. In Chicago, there's a place, Charlie Trotter's.
Uh-huh.
These were inaccessible to the public, which meant there was gigantic demand. Demand is what creates brands. So I saw the demand. This is a cultural revolution. People are now, when I would say to someone, what are you doing? Oh, I'm going to Spago tonight. Nobody when I was growing up said, I'm going to a restaurant, you know. It was like I'm going to see Led Zeppelin.
You don't even remember the name of the Chinese restaurant your parents went to include in the story.
But getting into Spago was a badge of honor for these people.
I see.
You know? And so to me, that was a cultural revolution. You could see it coming. But there was no face. There was no real face to it. There was nobody. And That's what I tried to do with Emmer on the other guys, was give it a face. In the case of the chefs, it was very complicated and very simple. In the case of musicians, highways existed to their audience. So if you think of Michael Jackson in the 1700s, he would be a wandering minstrel. The advent of stereos, radio, MTV made Michael Jackson what Michael Jackson is. Availability of someone to touch him anywhere in their universe. Mm-hmm. The chefs didn't, so I could take a music act like an Alice or a Teddy and move into those highways. Radio existed to touch people. I just had to get airplay. TV existed. I just had to get the clip on.
But for the chefs, it didn't exist.
It didn't exist. There were no highways. There was no, they were wandering minstrels. They cooked for 120 people in their location. Boy, that was it. So that was what I felt part of my job was. My first step was get the Food Network on the air, a highway to media, get pots and pans in the stores, get spices in the stores, a highway for people to touch them outside of their restaurants, get them to start doing multiple restaurants. So in different cities, you could get. And so that's a cultural revolution manifested.
By the way, I just wrote down highway to customers. Am I being a little anal by trying to come up with the bullet points from your life instead of just allowing the bigger lessons to wash over me?
No idea. Okay.
Cultural waves. I want to ask about that because it feels to me like when we were growing up, there was this big man theory of history, right? That the founders of Time magazine were big on that, that they were going to find a human being to say, this is the reason the world moved the way it did. We'll tell that human being's story and help you understand the world as it is today. I feel like that still sticks with us, this idea that if we want something, we can go and make it big. And what the cultural wave theory says is, you can't. Like, if you were a 1950s chef, you were not going to become an Emeril Lagasse. The people weren't ready for it, no matter how determined you are. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think you became Julia Childs.
I see.
Who had huge notoriety, but no public, no way to monetize it, but gigantic acclaim. And when the cultural wave comes, then you get both.
That you need that cultural wave, and so we have to pay attention
only for the giant home runs. Everybody, you know, everyone doesn't have to hit a home run. That doesn't have to be the goal in life always, is to get that gigantic, you know. Everybody doesn't have to be Elvis. But I think to partake in that gigantic art, I remember I had a lecture in school, and art always goes to a small audience, you know, whether it's a Warhol painting or a whatever, they're always smaller audiences. They're not millions and millions and millions. So you have to appeal to more than just the artistic, and the cultural wave plus the artistic point.
Okay, I want to ask you about something that I did. I do my own research for these interviews. I didn't just read your book, and I want to come back and ask you about some of the research I tried to do that didn't work out. But first, let me tell you and everyone else about acuity scheduling. You know, Shep, I wonder if you ever feel insecure. Do you feel insecure still to this day?
Oh, yeah.
No, not at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you do? Oh, good. Well, not. I guess so good is because
I wouldn't say insecure, but I have self-worth issues.
You do. How does that manifest itself? I'll come back to acuity in a moment.
In every action of every day.
Really? Do you have an example of something that's happened over the last few days?
I don't. It's a subtle filter. I wouldn't call it. It's not a dramatic filter, but it's a subtle filter.
Wow.
It's like not listening to my book.
Ah, we talked about that before you started. Right. Why don't you listen to your book?
I mean, it's some kind of self-worth something. I have no idea what, but it's...
like maybe it's not good enough.
Yeah, something.
You know what? Here's the thing. I love that you read your book. I wonder if like sometimes I hear pages turn in your book, which I don't usually hear. Maybe I'm listening more carefully than other times. Would that drive you crazy? That little bit of imperfection in yourself when you're looking for perfection in the rest? It would.
It wouldn't drive me crazy, but I would be a little... I know that the first four or five chapters I wasn't on target as much as I would have liked to be. As I started to get the rhythm after it. I think maybe that's why it's so hard for me to listen.
It's so good. It's so good, partially because of the frailties, partially the fact that when you say idea, you always pronounce it idea. Yeah. That is why it's good. Right. Like, I don't need a perfect voiceover artist for that. Here's what I was saying about acuity scheduling. I started doing these interviews, Shep, and I asked people to do interviews with me, and it just wasn't working. I couldn't get people to say yes often enough, and I said, it's me. They don't value me. I come from the bootstrap part of the internet world in New York, and a basement in Queens is where I started. They're very much Silicon Valley. They don't value me. And I got in my head about it, and then I realized, actually, it's not me. What if it's not? What happened was I was making it too tough for people to say yes. If I really were to stop and notice, I'd realize some people were reaching back out to me and saying, Andrew, I'm interested. When do we do it? And then I come back to them and say, when are you free? And then they tell me when they were free. And it was like back and forth until I'd lose touch with them and I think it's me. And that's when a mentor of mine, a guy named Bob Heiler, said, I did some research, Andrew. Try this. And he introduced me to acuity scheduling. It's I tell acuity scheduling when I'm available, which frankly for you, Shep, is any minute. You can call me up at 2 a.m. I'll be available to record this interview. But in general, you know, Tuesdays and Wednesdays are when I record between a specific block of times. I need a few minutes before and after the interview. I tell it all to acuity. Acuity then gives me a calendar that I could then give to every one of my guests. In fact, I embed it on my site. So now when I want someone to do an interview, I say, here's my availability. They book the time and boom. Suddenly it's not just that my interviews flow well. It's like I'm liked. Which I want to be liked. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying this to you guys in my audience, not because you're doing interviews. Your chances are not. You're not doing interviews. But you're trying to get your customers on the phone because you want to understand why they bought from you, or potential customers to understand what they're looking for from companies like yours. Or maybe like one of my past guests, you want everyone who's filling out a form for a week to at least reach out and connect with you on phone so you can understand why they're interested in your business and what you could create to sell to them. Whatever it is, if you're trying to get more people on the phone or more meetings, I really urge you to check out Acuity Scheduling. It's a great tool. There are more features than I'm going to get into here because I don't want to bore Shep with it. So instead, I'm going to tell you guys, it's also created by a longtime Mixergy fan who's giving us a lot of free time to use the software. If you want it, use this special URL. It's just for Mixergy people. It's AcuityScheduling.com/Mixergy. AcuityScheduling.com/Mixergy. I'm a little intimidated to read ads with you here, Shep, but then I have to realize you're an art and commerce guy.
Oh, yeah.
Right? If anything, I should be intimidated that I'm not killing it with the ads.
I think it's so great the companies are supporting you.
I do too.
Yeah, I think that's great.
You mentioned a name Joey in the book and how you guys split up.
Yep.
I said, Joey, I immediately go to Siri and I say, remind me in 2 hours to go look up who Joey is. Joey is Joe Greenberg. I found him online. Mm-hmm. He will not return my chat messages on Facebook. Our mutual friends will – basically, he doesn't want to talk to me, which I get. I'm curious. How does this co-founder factor into your story? Is this a little uncomfortable?
I wouldn't say it's uncomfortable in the bigger picture, and it's uncomfortable in the littlest of pictures, but it's in the middle, it's okay.
What do you mean? What's the big picture and little?
The big picture is that we, you know, we went through life together for many years. We ended up taking different paths, and mine has been very successful and high profile, and his has been good but not as successful. Mm-hmm. And I think at times it's painful for him, and I feel bad about that. On a small level, when I did the documentary, and I watched the documentary, I never asked for creative oversight from Mike. It was his movie. I let it be his movie. But when I saw the movie, I felt really bad that Joey had been left out of the movie because he's a very significant part of my success. And I went to Mike and I said, you know, I have one problem with the movie. And I told him what it was, and he said, well, I can't go back and fix it. And I said, well, can I get a card as soon as the movie ends where I thank him and at least, you know, let me give him his due? So I did that. The movie really upset him. We went through a very difficult period of time, which was not resolved. And then the book came out, and he read about the book coming out and got even more upset. And it became heated between us. And then he read the book. And after he read the book, he sent me a beautiful letter. And I think that's probably why he's not coming on the show.
But to not make it. By the way, I just asked him for
background. I think it's very painful for him. But life can be that way.
How did you guys connect?
We met at the bus station the first night. I got a Regent scholarship, lived in Oceanside. And that you could go to a New York State University school free. The furthest place was Buffalo, New York. And I wanted to get as far as I could get from my home. So I chose Buffalo. And I went up on a midnight bus to Buffalo from the Greyhound station in Manhattan. And I got there and I didn't even want to sit with my parents. It was that, you know, rebellious period of like walk across the street from me.
Yeah.
And there was a guy sitting in the corner. I went over to talk to him. His parents, he was the same. It was Joey. So we got on the bus together to go up to Buffalo and became best friends and went through the wars together.
The pharmaceutical industry that you were in, the pharmaceutical sales, you guys did it together. Yeah. What was? Can you remember a creative addition that he made to that helped Alice Cooper put himself establish himself?
He was the guiding force for a lot of the beginning.
What's one example of what he did for Alice Cooper and Murray?
We felt that we had to get Alice in the Fillmore. The Fillmore at that time was the place. If we couldn't get gigs anywhere, if you played the Fillmore
in L.A., right?
No, in San Francisco, with Bill Graham's Fillmore. And if you play there, then you could say Alice played at the Fillmore and clubs around the country would book you. So Joey hitchhiked up to San Francisco, I think took some acid, and sat in Bill Graham's office for 3 days. And when he finally got to meet him, he like seriously said, either you book the actor, I am going to murder you. And Joey, you could believe it from. And he booked. He thought it was a female folk singer, Bill. So he booked them on with Ike and Tina Turner. And I didn't go to the show. Joey went up with them. But Alice wore we had a coat made up of all dead rats, which he wore that night.
Literal dead rats?
Dead rats.
Real dead rats, okay.
Real dead rats. When we saw the Lady Gaga meat dress, we got hysterical. She's a student of Alice's, so she, you know... Real dead rats, because we were doing anything we could to piss off parents. Our goal was piss off parents. We didn't care about anything else. So Bill threw him off the stage. I remember the line that Joey said. The line was, either they fucking act or they fucking play music, but they're not doing both on my stage. So he was very significant. He was a real driving force.
And the reason that you guys split up was what?
That's tough to talk about.
It is.
Yeah, if he chose to, that would be his decision.
Would you be okay with him if he wanted to do an interview here and talk about it? And
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I love him. I mean, he's my brother.
Yeah. To this day. When was the last time you saw him for a meal?
Saw him for a meal right when the movie came out.
I see.
I wanted to see him before he saw it.
I see. I will say this. I don't know him well. But he's got people who really love him. I mean, I think that a lot of people were protecting him from me, and I had to really be clear to say, look, you can watch my body of work. I've not skewered anyone. I'm just trying to understand the story, and I'm looking for depth here. But I saw that they cared.
Yeah, he's a great guy and a great father. His kid's a fairly successful comedian.
We mentioned cultural waves, and you said that you know – how are you feeling, by the way? I'm looking at your eyes, and I could see when there's happiness, and I could see when I'm a little confused by how you're feeling. What is it? Is there? Yeah. Has Buddhism helped you with this stuff? You seem very
I'm not
set.
Buddhist.
You're not.
No.
Has your experience with Buddhism helped you?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
How?
Just beautiful, compassionate, service, joy. You know, all the things that I sort of believe in come true in the Buddhist world.
Do you still consider yourself Jewish?
Yeah.
Do you believe in God?
Yeah.
You do?
I don't know if the God is Jewish or not Jewish. I believe that somebody created this. This is not random.
But the Jewish version of God, not necessarily.
That I don't.
Do you do Kiddush?
I do the High Holy Days. Okay. I do go to temple once in a while. My high school buddy from the book, Dennis Greenstein, was just here.
Uh-huh.
And I just got a package. He sent me Shabbat candles.
I see.
He said, "Did you light Shabbat?" And I said, "No." He sent me the candles.
I see. And will you do the fast once a year?
I try to do the fast once a year. I go to temple. I think of myself as a cultural Jew. Mm-hmm. I cook a lot of Jewish food tonight. I'm making brisket. I have some friends coming in from Buffalo, so I'm making brisket and latkes and a
real
Jew.
You know the thing that got me in the book? you thought the Dalai Lama was vegetarian. I thought the Dalai Lama was vegetarian too. I just kind of assumed. Yeah. It turns out he eats meat.
I think he's back to vegetarian now, I think.
I wonder how he's – my wife's a lifelong vegetarian. I wonder how – and I've adopted it, so I'm not looking down on meat or lack of meat. I wonder how he squares that with reincarnation.
Doesn't – you know, he doesn't even – what he says is very – you know, is it better to kill 1,000 blades of grass or one cow?
Interesting. Okay. Interesting. That says a lot. I mean, I admire people who can say a lot in a statement like that.
He sees the miracle in everything. There's no difference to him between a piece of lettuce and a piece of meat in terms of the miracle of life. Hmm. You know, he sees the spirit and all, but he started to eat meat because of his health, his doctor.
I see.
Said he needed to start eating meat again. So that's why he did. But he loves meat.
I get it. I miss it. cultural waves. You notice some right now, huh?
Yeah, I'd say cannabis is a big cultural wave right now. I think the presidential election slowed it down, took some of the steam out, but I think follow the money always applies. And especially with this gang of characters that look like they're in the power. So I hope for the people who need it that that's true. But I think the only faces of the cannabis industry right now are exactly like the faces were of the culinary industry before the advent of the wave. In those days, Aunt Jemima had nothing to do with the food. Chef Boyardee, generic. In the cannabis world now, it's people like Bob Marley, Grateful Dead, who are great artists and great for CM endorsement, but they don't make the product. They don't grow the buds. They're not the core. They're taking advantage of the wave
They're like Michael Jackson with Pepsi as opposed to Emeril Lagasse with his spices.
Correct.
I see. So does Snoop Dogg then is – I see. So that's interesting. You can't capitalize on it by being associated with it. It has to be you creating it or participating in it.
No. I think Snoop will definitely – he will make a lot of money on it for sure. And Willie Nelson will make – they all make a lot of money. But for me, for what I do, it's an opportunity to take some – to create some real faces. You know, Chef Boyardee never could get to where Emeril could get to. It wasn't real. I don't know. Snoop Dogg can do great, but he's Snoop Dogg. Cannabis is, but I think there are faces. I've met people, growers, who are ex-Navy SEALs who are politically involved.
I see. And so you're working with them? Is this a project now?
No, I'm not, but I'm sort of trying to... I'm meeting with some of them because they come on Facebook and ask for advice. And there's a wonderful guy I met who was he trained the fighter pilots in the Air Force, the Tom Cruise pilots. Mm-hmm. I can't think of the name of them right now. Served 2 terms overseas, got wounded, came back, now has licenses in Las Vegas for cannabis. He's very politically active. He has a lot of friends who it's really helped with PDD, a lot of veterans. And he looks like the perfect, Republican face.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. And he's a wounded veteran. And he's,
So what's his path now? If we wanted to get him to rock stardom?
Right. His path is media, getting his story out, which I think is fairly simple to do. It was easier again before the election, but I think everybody in the media is playing around with the cannabis world. Nobody's really got humans to deal with. This is a perfect human.
I see.
This would be a perfect Sanjay Gupta interview. This would be a perfect Morning Joe interview. Okay. This is an all-American wounded veteran talking about not recreational, but the medicinal good that it does. And getting books out by him, getting the same thing, touching his audience in many ways. So getting books, maybe getting his brand out, because he does have a brand in Vegas. Mm-hmm. Getting him speaking at different events, getting him at South by Southwest as the face of cannabis. Mm-hmm. Just jumping ahead and saying, how I go to South by Southwest, which is the perfect spot, how do I get them to present him to their audience as the face of cannabis? So I would try and get an event that's called actually The Face of Cannabis.
I see.
And
it would need to be a din. I see. So it would need to be some kind of event, a party or something to highlight him.
It's one idea. You know, that's one thought.
As opposed to, the reason I'm highlighting that is opposed to what I might initially think of, which is how do we get him to speak and call Hugh over at South by Southwest and say that he should be speaking. No, you're saying it's got to be more than just a speech.
Yeah.
It's got to be an event.
Give them a reason to do it, a way to, you know, maybe come in with a sponsor. Mm-hmm. It's maybe the paraphernalia so that you're giving out stuff to draw people. Maybe it's a musical act tied with him. He's a wounded veteran. You can get a lot of, you know, a lot of support. Try and build an event that really define, you know.
And the event needs to stand up for what you say his vision, what he is, which is the face. I see. So in the beginning of Mixergy, I did an event at South by Southwest. I got to speak, but I also did an event, invited great people to speak, but it was a Mixergy event as opposed to an event that communicated what my message was. And that's the challenge. How do you communicate the message? Do you also have to irritate people or do something to shock them to get their attention?
It depends what you're trying to get to, but in this case, I don't think so. I think that I don't know the organizers of the South by Southwest, but I'm sure that many of them smoke cannabis. Many of them are very sensitive to the issue. We all love our veterans.
But it can't be like a smoke-off where you get together for a face of cannabis event and we're all smoking to kind of put it in your face. That's not that's distasteful.
It's really distasteful. For that, yeah. You know, I think the power is in the medical message.
Okay.
And the purity of it, you know, the selflessness of it.
Speaking of selflessness, I'm wondering why you did this interview. You don't need to sell more books. I understand if when you were back in book promotion mode, you did it, you'd say, I'm reaching out to an audience of business people who are likely to buy the book. They should buy the book. Why are you doing this? I'm grateful, but why? You don't know.
I guess because it's presented. I wake up in the morning. I mean, I think I say it in most of my stuff. I wake up in the morning. I do what I do. And I go to sleep at night. So it's not all goal-oriented. Jason has been really good to me.
Jason Gaynard. Good to me too. He lives that do for others attitude. The guy who founded Mastermind Talks. And how has he been good to you?
He contacted me when he saw I was doing the book, and he asked if he could help me. Did I have any desires that he could help me with? And I said, you know, I would love to be on the New York Times bestseller list for my ego.
Okay.
And, he said, I can help you with that. And I sort of trusted him, and he did. We made the bestseller list. It's been a great relationship. So he was here. He came with his family. A couple of weeks they spent here.
To your place in Hawaii?
Yes.
Wow.
That was my thank you gift to him. It was thank you for the help. And then when he was here, he said that he had a friend who did podcasts, and he wanted to do me, and it's absolutely whatever you want.
Wow. I'm so glad. I don't know how I'm – here's the weird thing about it, that he did this for me. It means so much –
It's a coupon.
I guess he does. Maybe that's a good way to put it, because I was going to say, I feel so guilty. He did so much for me on this. He really went out of his way, kept following up. I guess I feel guilty, but you're right. Just think of it as a coupon. He's got a coupon with me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? If he ever needs anything, he can come in.
You know, we're the only ones who can do it. Humans. Nobody else.
I feel like now the other thing about this coupon is he could come out of nowhere and ask me for something, and what if I can't do it? What if I don't follow through for some reason?
You'll figure out how to do it.
That's it. That's the attitude. Yeah. All right. Well, for Jason, I would do it even if he didn't have a coupon with me. He's such a good guy.
Yeah, great guy.
All right. Well,
you asked me earlier about Buddhism, and he has all those qualities that I am attracted to in Buddhism without being a Buddhist.
You know? Including the shaved head. Does he still buzz his head?
The shaved head, yeah. But he's compassionate. He's of service. He's selfless. All the good stuff, and he's joyful.
Yeah, he really is. Well, thank you so much for doing this interview. This is the one interview my wife has just been talking about. So, did you get to do it yet? Has it happened? I've been looking forward to it. there's no reason for me to say to people that they should go get the book, because, I mean, not for you, for my sake, frankly, if you get the book or the audio book, you're going to love it so much that you're going to think higher of me for it. And the documentary, if you like documentaries, is fantastic. I thought Mike Myers did such a good job with it.
The only thing I wish he'd done is,
tell me if you agree with this. He said that when he was hurt, you rescued him like a little bird whose wing was broken and you helped him. You got so personal in that video, in that documentary. I wish you would have gotten personal about what crushed him, to let him have a little bit of that heart. And it felt like he was holding himself back in a place where it was safe to be open. Agree?
A little bit, yeah. I think he's – you know, comedians are very guarded. It's an occupational risk.
I get it. I guess, yes.
I think because they expose themselves so hard in their actual craft, I don't know. But I know his dad had passed away. It was a rough time for him. I was really glad that I could help.
I was too. There's not really much for you. You're not going to get more clients from it. I imagine you got a lot more Facebook contact than maybe you wanted in your life. But I tend to think, you know, that Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are out there calling billionaires saying, please give your money back, commit at the end of your life to give your money back. I say, yeah, that's nice. Actually, it's really helpful. I don't want to minimize it. But I really would like more people who've done great things in their lives to come back and say, here's how I did it. Because I grew up with a Persian dad who would, like, at the dinner table, talk about what he learned from his grandparents, what he learned from his parents. There was this experience. We're kind of missing out on it. And just like the old chefs used to make good food, and as you said, you did this gesture, at the end of the night, it goes away. I feel like we do these great things, and at the end of our lives, it's just like, goes away. But I'll tell you, 100 years from now, 2,000 years from now, somebody's going to read your book and they'll get something out of it, even if it's just like through a chip in their heads in a way that we don't anticipate. And I'm glad that you did it, and I appreciate that it's out there.
Thank you.
All right, and thank you for doing this interview. Thank you all for being a part of it. Remember the two sponsors, the company that will help you hire your next great developer, toptal.com/Mixergy, and the company that will keep you from feeling like a loser that nobody loves and actually get calls from get you sales calls and support calls, go to acuityscheduling.com/Mixergy, acuityscheduling.com/Mixergy. Supermensch, thank you so much for doing this.
Mahalo.
Mahalo.
Sure.
Oh, yes, the shirt. What does it say? Don't blame me. I voted for Alice with a picture of Alice Cooper right in the center of the t-shirt. I love it. So, I love that you took the time to get undressed on camera with me to put that t-shirt on. That little bit of detail mattered a lot. Thank you so much. Bye, Chef.
Thank you. Aloha.
Aloha.